The following audio presentation is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Family Studies as part of our monthly seminar series in which we showcase national and international research related to the family. The seminars are designed to promote a forum for discussion and debate. They are open to the public and free of charge.
Thanks, Jenny. It's fantastic to be here. And yes, Jenny, I thought that was very generous saying several years ago when we met as new investigator network. So it's my great pleasure to be here with Nick and with Jenny and with Ellen as well, and already some familiar faces in the audience. So thank you for coming. I'd like to add my acknowledgement of the traditional owners of the land that we're on today and pay my respects to elders past and present as well. So racism in schools is a very topical issue. If you've been watching the media lately, I think nearly every day we see an article in the media about racism, about what it is, what it isn't, how much is there in Australia, and how we should or shouldn't be protecting people against racism. So obviously there's a lot of contextual factors around the issue of racism, but we're going to focus specifically about racism in schools and on some of the data that Nick and I have been working on with colleagues around the experiences of students here in Australian schools. But I just wanted to take a moment first by talking about what is and isn't racism in terms of the conceptual definitions that we're using in our work. So as I've just said, alarmingly, racism appears to be worsening both in Australia, as you've seen the reports coming out from Andrew Marcus's social cohesion surveys. They're finding increasing reports of experiences of racism from people from non-English speaking backgrounds and internationally as well. Andrew's study that's just come out found 41% of non-English speaking background immigrants who arrived between 2000 and 2010 were reporting experiences of racism. So within that wider context of increasing racism in Australia, schools can be a real microcosm of society where those intercultural tensions and racism often occurs as young people are negotiating those intercultural tensions that they're seeing within the wider environment. And people like Fethi Mansouri and others have talked about how schools can be a real very important setting of socialisation in which race and racism can be normalised and often racist behaviours and attitudes as well can either be countered or perpetuated. So what is racism? We could probably have a whole 2-hour discussion just on that today. But this is the definition that we use in our work. So it's really focused on an inequitable distribution of opportunity, of benefit or resources across ethnic and racial groups. And a key point here is that it occurs through avoidable and unfair actions. There are always going to be differences between different groups of people, but it's when those are resulting from unfair and avoidable actions. And it can be expressed in a range of different ways, and this feeds directly into the debate over the RDA at the moment, but it can be about attitudes, about beliefs, behaviours and norms and practices, and it can be intentional or unintentional, and that's a really important fact to think about, particularly in relation to children and young people. And of course, it's only one manifestation of a broader phenomenon of oppression, and we're going to be talking about racism today, but there's a lot of discussion too around how do we think about racism within the context of other forms of oppression and intersectionalities, and I'm happy to talk to anyone who's interested about that later. It's also important to think about racism within the context of both prejudice and power. So whenever there's oppression, there is one group that's being marginalised or oppressed, but there's also another group that's being privileged. And that's very important to recognise both conceptually and also when we're thinking about addressing racism, is that when you're trying to counter prejudice and prevent racism, there is another group that is being privileged, and that's often why we get so much resistance when we're talking about addressing racism and providing diversity, because you're challenging another group's privilege, whether it's recognised or not by that group. So here's some examples. We talk about racism across three main levels. You can see in the middle is the one that most people will think about when they think about racism. So racism that's operating at an interpersonal level. So a verbal comment, a form of abuse. As you can see here, the example, someone racially abusing another person when they're walking along or driving in the street. It's also important to recognise more systemic forms of racism, so that's where particular groups in society are oppressed or they are not given the same opportunities as another one through the conditions, the practices, the policies and processes present within a particular organisation, within an institution, or just the systems and the culture, I guess, of how the society operates. So for example here, young Indigenous Victorians are 2 to 3 times more likely to be arrested or charged with an offence because of systemic injustices within the criminal justice system, for example. The third one, which is increasingly getting attention within certainly the racism and health literature, but still a lot more work to be done, is where the minority group themselves takes on the beliefs about their own group that are held by the majority. So, take on a view that they might be inferior or not able to perform, and we often see that within the education system. People from a minority group believe, oh, I can't do that because I'm Indigenous or because I'm a migrant or African American. And there's some work coming out now that shows that students, some work being done in the States, where minority young people will actually, who have in higher levels of internalised racism, have poor chronic disease outcomes. So it's equally as harmful on their outcomes. So this is a study that's been done here in Australia by a market research company, interestingly enough, asking people what is racist. And I just want to, I won't go into this in too much detail because I want to get into our data, but just to show that there's a huge continuum about where people are saying something is or isn't racist. So you can see on the right there, people are very clear out in the community that someone missing out on a job because of their ethnic background, someone being assaulted, that's very clearly racist or discriminatory. And usually people will say something that causes harm or unjust treatment, yeah, absolutely, that's racism. But if you go sort of to the middle, people are a bit confused, or they're undecided about what is and isn't racism. So is asking a colleague to speak on behalf of their whole culture, is that racism or not? People aren't quite sure. Or is ringing a bank to complain that the call centre is staffed by Indian people and not able to understand, is that racism or is that not? And then further to the left, most people in the community will say invoking a perceived positive stereotype about an ethnic group, oh, that's not racist. But we actually know that whole spectrum of different sort of scenarios up there can all be harmful. And in some situations can be considered expressions of prejudice or invoking unhelpful stereotypes that then can perpetuate inequalities. So I just want to put that up there just to kind of get you thinking really around the complexity of even the issue, which I'm sure many of you are thinking about in terms of why you're even here today to engage with this talk. When we talk about exposure to racism, obviously there's a whole range of different factors that we need to consider. What's the timing of that exposure? Was it in utero, infancy, childhood, of what period of development? What's the intensity of that experience? And how does that relate to the induced cognitive or allostatic load on the psychological or the physiological system? How frequent was it? And also, what was the duration of that experience? And also, what was the characteristic of that racism? What form did it take? Was it overt? Was it covert? At what level, how was it expressed, in what setting, and who were the perpetrators? Quite complex to think about in terms of how do we then think about how does all of that gamut of experiences then influence a school student and their outcomes. So I want to move now a bit more into thinking about how racism does affect children and young people. We know from the theoretical and the emerging empirical literature that children and young people are particularly vulnerable to racism's harmful effects through a range of different pathways that can be both direct experiences of racism that they experience themselves, as well as vicarious experiences in which they either witness racism or a caregiver or a close family member experiences racism which they may or may not witness. It's recognised as important but as yet quite under research. And of course the effects of racism on children and young people can be influenced by a huge range of different factors. So the child's cognitive and social emotional development, the other family members' experience of racism, what are the parental attitudes, so the ethnic racial socialisation, and how parents are equipped or not equipped to support their children to negotiate those experiences. And then, of course, neighbourhood and community and societal factors, so the level of diversity within the community that the child's in, the level of discrimination within the wider community, the other support systems that they're able to access. So these are some of the hypothesised pathways by which racism can affect ill health. So linking back to our first definition, inequitable and reduced access to the societal resources required for health, and Nick will talk about some of this in relation to education in his talk. And in relation to children and young people, this may affect the child accessing some of these factors, but it can also influence their parent accessing these, so that can be a dual, lack of access to resources needed for health. This racism is a stressor. So stress and negative emotional and cognitive reactions, as we know, has many negative impacts on mental health, as well as affecting immune endocrine functions. And increasingly people are thinking that a lot of the chronic disease inequalities we're seeing in Aboriginal communities or in other minority groups could be related to some experiences of racism as a stressor. Then the internalisation of stigma and racist beliefs about yourself, leading to poor self-worth and poor self-esteem. That's one of the hypothesised pathways in terms of poor educational outcomes particularly. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of work coming out now around fear of racism, and even if it's not... So this increased vigilance and anticipatory anxiety when people are going to situations, including going to school, am I going to experience this today? And that either resulting in avoidant behaviour of not actually going into that setting, or having an increased stress response, and obviously impaired interpersonal reactions, particularly among young people, increased smoking, alcohol and drug use, as well as those more maladaptive responses to racism when it happens, disengagement from healthy activities, and of course a racially motivated assault is particularly harmful to somebody's health. So really quickly, before I go into the data that we've collected here in Victoria, this is a systematic review that colleagues and I just published. And you can see within that huge theoretical concept around racism and child health to that, well, when we did the review, there are only 121 studies internationally, empirically, quantitatively looking at the effects of racism and child and youth health, and most of which showing negative associations between racism and negative mental health, as well as, you can see there, positive mental health, behaviour problems, well-being, interestingly pregnancy and birth outcomes also highly significant. So you can see this is really an emerging area of work, which is why, and I'll come to this at the end too, and I'm sure we'll talk about any questions, Ace and Nick and I are pursuing some grant opportunities to pursue this work, but also a critically important area for our children and young people. So, student reports of racism at school in Australia, what do we actually know? Not very much, unfortunately. But what we do know, these are some of the three key studies from children who are reporting experiences of racism themselves here in Australia. So I'll start at the bottom first. So this is one that came out through the Foundation of Young Australians a couple of years ago, and they surveyed students across 18 Australian secondary school students in that study. 80% of the non-Anglo students were reporting that they had experienced racism during their lifetime, and over two-thirds of those experiences had happened at school. Another smaller study that I was involved with through the education department here, students reported whether racism was a problem at their school. About 65% strongly agreed or agreed that that was the case. And then the study that I'm going to be talking about now in more detail, 22% of students reported direct experiences of racism every day at school, and nearly half of them that they had witnessed or that they were aware that other students were experiencing racism on a daily basis. So quite high prevalence rates. Okay, so this study is part of the Localities Embracing and Accepting Diversity project, which was a local government initiative where local governments here in Victoria were funded by a consortium of organisations to implement whole of local government strategies across multiple settings to promote diversity and address racism. And I was involved in the evaluation of that rather than the implementation of the intervention, particularly around evaluating what was happening within schools within that wider program. So we collected data across 5 primary schools and 4 secondary schools, using focus groups with the primary school students as well as surveys, and it's the surveys that I'll be talking about today, where we captured students' reports of experiences of discrimination, their attitudes towards diversity, their adult and student expectations towards intercultural contact, so their motivation to respond without prejudice, essentially, their motivated fairness, as well as some simple mental health measures. So you can see here, I hope you can see that graph at the back okay, the types of direct racism experienced by students monthly or more. So for direct racism, most reported experiences were reported to be perpetrated by students rather than teachers, so that's a positive thing, I think, in some ways. And that the most common experience students reporting were being told that they didn't belong in Australia. So nearly 20% reported that they had been told that at least monthly by other students. The other sorts of questions we asked were, you can see there, 16.5% said that other students didn't want to play with them because of their cultural background. Still concerning, I think, that 9% of students reported that they thought a teacher had thought that they couldn't do something because of their cultural background. And similarly, 15% you were left out by a student, or 14% you were spat on, pushed or hit by another student because of your cultural background. Of course, people want to know, well, how did that pan out across the different cultural backgrounds of the students? So in this study, we were only able to ask the students what country they had been born in and also what country their mother and father were born in. So we categorised students into groups of students that were born in English-speaking countries whose parents were also born in English-speaking countries, students who were born in English-speaking countries but parents were born in non-English-speaking countries, and then students and parents who were both born in non-English-speaking countries there. And you can see here, this is a cumulative proportion of students experiencing direct racism monthly or more. So there were 6 different forms of racism that students reported, and you can see here that is proportionally decreased. The key groups to look at here, I probably have a pointer, but I probably can't work out how to use it. So red is the students born in an English-speaking country and whose parents were born in an English-speaking country, and then the purple is the students who were born in a non-English-speaking country. That's really hard to say quickly. And whose parents were also born in a non-English-speaking country. The blue, interestingly, is children who didn't know where either they or their parents were born. And that is possibly students who are from the or whose parents are from a refugee or a humanitarian entrance background, as I actually don't know. The youngest of the students was 8, so usually by that age they should know where they're from. And you can see there very clearly who was experiencing the most racism. So there were statistically significant differences there. Okay, and again, when we look at that on a daily basis, you can see there that 22.5% were reporting direct experiences of racism every day. But interestingly, we didn't find any significant differences across demographics within that frequency of experience. So we need a bigger sample size to work out what's going on there, and probably more refined measures of racial ethnic background. Similarly to direct racism, children born in a non-English-speaking country with parents also born in a non-English-speaking country were significantly more likely to report witnessing one or more types of vicarious racism monthly or more compared to the reference group of born in an English-speaking country with their parents. So 78% compared to 64%, and you can see there the most common experience on a monthly basis was knowing that other students had been called names or teased. That's still quite high there, vicarious experiences in terms of other students being left out at 45%, and 40% knowing that students had been. So fairly high prevalence rates. Okay, when we look at monthly or more, I was reading the wrong thing, sorry. So this is also looking at students reported motivated fairness towards people from different cultural groups. So it is encouraging to think that 85% of students are saying it's important to me that I'm nice, so they have some level of internal motivation to be fair to students from other cultural backgrounds. Interestingly, it's lower. The other students expect them to be nice to students from other cultural backgrounds, but also very high levels that they know that adults and teachers expect them to be fair towards people from different cultural groups. And we also found that when we looked at that, female students were much more likely to report than male students that they felt motivated to be fair to people from other cultural backgrounds. So we need to find out what that gender difference is. So yeah, 53.5% of females compared to only 32% of male students. So we need to find out what that's about. Is it like any research study, there's always more questions than answers at the end of it, isn't it? And so in terms of reported intercultural attitudes here, so this is really invoking some of the stereotype models around competence and warmth towards people from different cultural groups. Less than half of students reported positive intercultural attitudes towards people from different cultural groups. So I think that's quite concerning and might actually speak into, on the flip side, students reported experiences of racism. And I'm going way too slow. I might flip through this one and get to the key findings at the end. But this is just looking at some bivariate associations between these experiences of racism, the student intercultural attitudes and their motivated fairness and mental health. And you can see there some of the, I've highlighted in bold, some of the significant findings of what was related to what. So you can see there down the bottom that direct experiences of racism were related to lower levels of motivated fairness and intercultural attitudes, as you would expect, and also some quite significant, and we did some multivariable models as well, but looking at direct effects of direct experiences of racism on student reported loneliness and sadness. So these are the adjusted odds ratios. Interestingly, for majority students, those with more friends from other cultures, it was associated with greater levels of loneliness and sadness. So possibly the students who are making an effort to go and be friends with students from other cultural backgrounds are then exploited by the other kids. So that's quite concerning. And in terms of the mental health outcomes, similarly to what the adolescent literature is saying, direct racism is associated with greater levels of loneliness and sadness after adjusting for all of the other confounders. And interestingly, nobody's found this previously, and we really want to look at this in when we get our grant, Alan. is that motivated fairness? So having higher levels of motivated, have I got that around the right way? So being more motivated to be fair to other students, yeah, predicts great less loneliness. Yeah, that's right. So if you're more motivated to be fair, you're less lonely to be schooled. So we can actually argue that promoting diversity and positive attitudes actually helps everybody and potentially promotes mental health at school. So that's a very emergent finding, but we need to actually work on that again across a greater sample. Oh, I'm just going to skip through. I was going to show you some qualitative data, but we'll just have to wait for that for next time. So where does this take us? Clearly, experiences of racism and attitudes towards diversity are ongoing concerns in schools, both potentially associated with poor student outcomes. But despite those key findings from our smallish community-based sample here in Victoria, we do need more population-level data to really understand these factors across a greater sample of students in multiple contexts. Particularly, there's a need for more robust measurement tools, and I'm very happy that one of my honours students in the room today is working on some of these measurement tools with us, so that we can actually compare and contrast this across racial ethnic groups and across different family and school and neighbourhood contexts, you know, do some of the multi-level modelling and really tease. And we've been talking with Jenny and Ben and Alan about doing some of this. We do need longitudinal designs to really look at these moderating and mediating factors over time, particularly given the developmental processes of children and young people. Something I'm also quite passionate about is looking at the intersections between racism and other forms of discrimination and bullying, and how do they actually feed in and mutually reinforce one another in terms of children's outcomes. And of course, we don't want to just talk about the problem, we actually want to use the evidence that we do have to inform action to promote positive attitudes towards diversity and counter racism's harmful effects on children and young people. Thank you. Council.
Okay, so thanks everyone for coming along. I'd also like to acknowledge the fact that I can't put a lapel mic on. So in addition to my inability to use technology, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land in which we meet. What I'm talking about is uses data from a lot of surveys involving Indigenous people, and I'd like to acknowledge the contribution which Indigenous people have made to all this data collection and the burden which it puts on the Indigenous population, and recognise that that we need to make the most of the available data we have given that burden. So Naomi's kind of given a really good background to definitions of racism, different experiences of racism, and a little bit of empirical data on mainly migrant groups. So what I'm going to talk about is a focus on the Indigenous population, and there's a couple of reasons for doing that. The main one being that there's, like the evidence which Naomi put up, there's very strong evidence of both the effect and the experience of experiences of racism amongst Indigenous people, and but also I think that the context and the way in which that plays out is very different to a migrant population. So I think it's worth kind of looking at those separately. So I'm going to start by talking about the policy context, look at the potential effects of attendance on outcomes. So I'm going to focus on the way in which racism affects attendance at school and then the effect on other outcomes. Look at how experiences of racism might be associated with attendance, and then focus on what predicts or explains that experience. Okay, so why ultimately are we interested in experiences of racism amongst Indigenous school kids? Well, this is the six closing the gap targets which the current federal government and previous federal government have agreed to in conjunction with most of the states and territories, and they relate to they highlight the focus of current policy around Indigenous affairs. I'm not going to go into each in detail. What I wanted to highlight is the potential effect of experiences and racism on all aspects of the closing the gap targets, and all aspects of the ability of governments to meet their closing the gap targets. So Naomi's talked a lot about and written a lot about health, and so there's a clear overlap here between the headline target of closing life expectancy gap, but also mortality rates of kids, the effects of racism on parents, and the effect that has on their kids. But my focus though is on schools and the way in which the experiences of Indigenous kids affects their willingness and ability to participate in the school system. So I guess that's been the framework for a while. More recently, the most recent change of government has brought a slight change of focus on in Indigenous policy. So what I've got here is a quote from the Prime Minister's report, which says the Australian government's highest priority in Indigenous affairs is getting children to school. So there's a clear corollary there, which is that if you get kids to school, then they'll improve their literacy and numeracy, which will improve their employment outcomes, which will improve their health outcomes and the outcomes of their kids. That's a tenuous link, but it clearly highlights the need to understand why it is that Indigenous kids are less likely to attend both enroll and attend school on a regular basis. And here is the current government approach to attendance. It's a bit of a evolving policy space, but I think this kind of highlights the way in which this current government and other governments see attendance being improved. And I guess if you kind of read through it, implicit in the view is that low attendance amongst Indigenous kids is driven by kind of three main things. Remoteness, so there's a huge focus on remote schools, experience in receipt of welfare. The main policy focus is school enrollment attendance through welfare, and also the effects of attending a public school with a focus, with an increased budget on sending kids scholarship opportunities to send Indigenous kids to private schools and usually in urban areas. And I have no argument against some of these focuses. There's no doubt that remoteness makes it much more difficult to attend school. Income support has less, there's less evidence for. But my point is it's a very narrow focus, and we need to kind of understand what it is above and beyond these three main areas which are discouraging Indigenous kids from attending school. So is experiences of racism or unfair treatment one part of that explanation? So before I get into the experience of kids, I want to talk a little bit about adults. And that's partly because of kind of what Naomi talked about, is how the experiences of adults and families can shape child outcomes, partly through internalized racism, but also the way in which parents and carers make decisions on behalf of kids. If a parent has a bad experience with a particular institution, then they're much less likely to encourage their kids to engage in that institution. So this data comes from the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Survey. It's a bit old now, it's 2008, but it's the most recent data which we have. And asked, in the last year, have you felt that you have been treated unfairly because you're Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander? So it's a very broad measure of experiences of racism, but it's kind of the best we have. And what we found is that about 28% of Indigenous adults reported that they experienced some form of discrimination in the previous year. And when you extrapolate that across the life course, you can see that the majority of Indigenous adults would experience racism at some point in time. This gives the locations or the context in which that racism experienced, and kind of similar to what Naomi found, you find a very high percentage of those experience unfair treatment by members of the public, by police, but also in the labour market. So how does that affect kids? Well, in some analysis we did which I did with Jeff Bath using the longitudinal study of Indigenous children, we found that children whose carers felt they were discriminated against because of their Indigenous status are significantly less likely to be attending preschool than those who didn't report that discrimination. So the experience of parents will then affect the experience of kids. There's a high degree of acceptance amongst the total Australian population for the notion that Indigenous Australians experience prejudice, but only a small minority of the general population reported that they themselves had negative attitudes towards the Indigenous population. And that says to me that a lot of the experiences of Indigenous people are coming from those who don't know or aren't aware of the effects which their actions might be having. So that's the potential effect of implicit prejudice. And getting once again, kind of coming back once again to Naomi's point about internalised racism, much of the view within the total population relate to aspects of Indigenous behaviour, Indigenous attitudes. So a high percentage of people saying that a low percentage of people saying Indigenous Australians were hardworking, and a low percent saying they were disciplined. Okay, so that's kind of the context, kind of trying to give you a bit of a sense of the family context, the political context in which child experiences are taking place. So next I'm going to move the focus on explicitly on school attendance. And the first thing I want to do is just show, given the amount of money, the amount of attention, is school attendance an issue? Is it worth focusing on? Does it affect long-term outcomes? You can think of instances where it doesn't, and that depends on what other activities the kids are undertaking. But there's reasonably strong evidence that school attendance is one of the factors which is affecting later school outcomes, literacy and numeracy. So all this graph gives here is I'm using a standardized test score with a mean of 0, standard deviation of 1, and then look at how these different factors are associated with those test scores. Grey bars for the Indigenous population, hollow bars for the non-Indigenous population, above the line saying that this is associated with better literacy and numeracy, below the line saying it's associated with worse, and stars, whether it's statistically significant. So all I really wanted to show here is that, yes, attendance is one of the factors. If you miss school 1 month or 2 months, for both Indigenous and non-Indigenous populations, associated with lower rates of literacy and numeracy by the age of 15, but it's only one of the factors. So we also need to look at the effect of those experiences of racism on our preschool participation. So if those parents are less likely to send their kids to preschool, and that's, therefore that has long-term effects on the child's outcomes. So attendance is important, but it's not the only thing. It's not the only way in which racism might be affecting later school outcomes. So hopefully I convinced you that attendance is important. What are the determinants of attendance? And is racism or experiences of racism one of them? So what I'm going to do is use two sets of data, one from the longitudinal survey study of Indigenous children to look at young kids' experiences, and then the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander survey to look at the total school population. Okay, so the first set of results looks at the factors associated with whether a child attended school every day in the previous week. This is using wave 3 of the L6, so the kids here are about 6 or 7 years old. And then I look at, these are the responses from kids, and these are responses from parents. So there's other variables here which I control for, which I don't include in the graph: age, sex, location, and some characteristics of the carers. So what I want to focus on is basically three main findings. First is that the child's experiences in school affects, or at least associated with, their attendance. So if the child says that the children in their school are nice to them, they're more likely to have attended school every day in the previous week. So child's agency, what's happening to the child, is important in explaining attendance. Now this isn't quite getting at experiences of racism. You don't have that on the L6 yet, but you can easily see how that could be an experience, or be similarly affected by experiences of racism. The other major finding, though, is that one of the key determinants of attendance is the child's health. So if a child is reported as having fair or poor health, then they're significantly and quite substantially less likely to attend school every day in the previous. That makes perfect sense. You go into school if you're not healthy. But following on from Naomi's presentation, well, health is likely to be substantially affected by experiences of racism, so it's a mediating factor. the effect of those experiences on child health and then on attendance. The final thing I wanted to show is that our focus on kids who are in receipt of welfare is probably a little bit miss a large proportion of the population. So the hollow bars are those where the difference isn't particularly significant. And what you can see is those children who live in families whose main source of income is not wages or salary, so that's mainly government transfers, are not any more or less likely statistically to attend school on a regular basis. So what that means is that attendance is an issue for a much broader population than that just those in receipt of welfare. So that's any form of attendance. But what about the child's decision not to attend school? So what I look at here is the difference in probability of having missed any days of school in the previous year without permission. Now it's a little bit that this is reported by the parents, by the carer, and of course a lot of the days which the kids miss, the parents have no idea about. That's why they don't do it without permission. But having said that, it tells us something about a form of unexplained absences. That's absences which the parent is aware of, but the kids for reasons above and beyond what the permission from the parents. So once again, there's a larger model which includes a few other carer characteristics, but none of those were found to be significant. So what I look at is the characteristics of the carer, school attendance, some forms of stress, and also the experiences of the best measure we have of experiences of racism in school. So I'll ignore the racism to start with and just highlight a couple of things. Carers, not surprisingly, what we find with a lot of results is that relatively well-educated parents or less well-educated parents, kids are more likely to have missed school without permission. And that might have something to do with why do those parents have relatively low levels of education? Well, because of the negative experiences they had in school, which then feeds through to the kids' view of school. Housing stress, structural problems associated, and in particular, family crises. So what's going on in the family has a big association with attendance. Health conditions doesn't really appear to be associated with the child or the youth decision. So that's more affecting those other forms of absence as opposed to unexplained absence. And finally, if you weren't bullied or treated unfairly because of your Indigenous status in the previous 12 months, then you're significantly less likely to miss school without permission. So even controlling for the housing stress and all those things, just highlighting that bullying or unfair treatment is because of your Indigenous status. So that is an important explanatory variable for school attendance. Okay, so what I've tried to get up to now is okay, well, let's look at the policy context. Attendance is a focus. Is attendance important? Yes, it is. It explains academic outcomes. Well, what explains attendance? Health, but also experiences of racism. Okay, so what predicts whether a child, whether an Indigenous child experiences some form of bullying or unfair treatment due to their Indigenous status? And that's what I'm going to look at in the final set of results. Okay, so the dependent variable here is whether the carer reported that the child experienced some form of bullying or unfair treatment because of their Indigenous status. So one, you're already missing out on those experiences which the child doesn't tell their carer or family, so you're missing out some aspects of that experience. But what is it? Once again, below the line, below this line, means you're less likely to experience it. Above the line, more likely to. Dark bars, difference is significant. Hollow bars, the difference is not significant. So what are the main findings? Well, first, that remoteness is a protective factor against experiences of unfair treatment and bullying. So those Indigenous kids who live in remote areas are less likely to report to their carer they experience that unfair treatment. And there's a few potential explanations for this, and some of it kind of flows from Naomi's work around the characteristics of those in the schools in which Indigenous kids are attending. So the majority of Indigenous kids in non-remote areas, in particular, attend schools where there are very few other Indigenous kids. And it appears from this evidence and from other evidence that that's a key predicting factor for experiences of racism. So that's kind of one thing counters to a certain extent the exclusive focus on remote schools in terms of attendance. Mobility is a predictive factor. So those Indigenous kids who've moved in the previous 5 years, and there is data on more frequent moves, and we'll look at that. But any form of mobility is associated with experiences of unfair treatment or bullying. And that makes sense as well. I mean, think about the longer time you've had in a particular school, the greater scope you've had to develop those social networks and to develop strategies to avoid those sources of bullying or unfair treatment. Living in a household with non-Indigenous residents is a protective factor, and this is something which I wasn't predicting beforehand. So our evidence using the LSIC has shown a slightly different result, that living in a non-Indigenous mixed household is a predictive factor, so something we need to look into in a little bit more detail. But it does show, once again, that the family experience matters. And it might be that those kids in non-Indigenous households have some form of protection from the experience which the other household members had. Not surprisingly, well, maybe it is a bit surprisingly, experiences of bullying and unfair treatment increases across the school career. So very low for preschool, and then the base case here is high school, which is substantially higher than the other school types. And finally, what I thought is a very interesting finding and something we need to look into in a bit more detail is there's no real association with whether the school teaches about Indigenous culture. And you can kind of think of plausible explanations for why that might have both a positive and a negative effect on experiences of racism, experiences of unfair treatment and bullying. It might, in terms of a positive, teaching about Indigenous culture might have a positive effect or a protective effect in terms of increasing understanding of other kids in the school, but it might have a negative effect in terms of creating difference amongst the school body. And what this shows is on average, there's no effect. So what I think we therefore need to look at is what types of teaching about Indigenous culture have those positive effects, and which ones have those negative effects. So this data I'm not going to go through. It talks about the experiences of 15-year-olds, but I'll just quickly tell you what the main results were in the summary. Okay, so what do I think are the main findings from the analysis on Indigenous kids? So first, that there's some justification for the focus on attendance, but this needs to be supported by a range of evidence, and that health is a critical determinant, and that may be a potential mediating effect of racism. attendance is the only issue, explaining poor outcomes and early childhood experiences, and other factors are important, and once again they might be affected again by experiences of racism. Experiences vary substantially across the population, and as Naomi mentioned, it'd be good to have longitudinal data to look at the cumulative effects of racism, whether there's particular groups who experience have repeated experiences. What I didn't show is that schools in which Indigenous students attend explain some of the variation in student experience, but even in the same school, Indigenous students are less likely to feel the teachers are fair and just. So it's not just the schools which they attend. And finally, I wouldn't be an academic if I didn't talk about the work which we need to do. There is much we don't know about the Indigenous students' experiences of racism. And these are the ones which I think are important, and it'd be good to have a bit of a discussion about the ones you guys think are important. That's it. Thanks.